Welcome to the interview portion of Power Talk, and I'm very excited today to have Dr. Barbara DeAngelis with me. She's invited us into her home, and she's actually about to move, so we're getting the last experience here in her home. Barbara, if you're not familiar with her, is the executive director of the Los Angeles Personal Growth Center. She's the creator of the popular relationship seminar, Making Love Work, and what you probably know her for is her best-selling books, How to Make Love All the Time, kind of a fun title, and Secrets About Men Every Woman Should Know. She writes on a regular basis for Cosmopolitan, Ladies Home Journal, McCall's, Reader's Digest, and she's the popular media personality who appears frequently on Oprah Winfrey, Sally Jesse Raphael, not to mention the fact that she has a variety of cassette tapes that can give you strategies and how to succeed in each area of relationships. So I hope you'll take advantage of those. I want to thank you for letting us in your home and a chance to visit with you.
Thank you. You're the last and best experience here.
Well, thank you. Well, I like to start out our Power Talks by having people get a chance to know who you are. And my experience of you has been exciting in the last few days as I've just immersed myself in your material and getting a chance to listen to you on the radio and meet you personally. And the thing I'm struck by, as I told you earlier, is just your genuineness. You really care about people. That's really obvious to me. And your willingness to just give of yourself. So I think it'd be great for people to understand, before they hear some of your ideas, a little bit about what got you here. I found a lot of people have had a lot of challenges, and that's what brought them to the place of being able to share. So could you tell me what originally happened in your life that made you put such a focus on human relationship and how to make it better?
Painful experience.
Oh, you said the right thing. That's what I teach.
No. I feel I was obviously born to do this. I mean, I've been directed in this place and on this path from the events way back in my life. I remember when I was at summer camp, I must have been about 9 or 10, and I would write letters or notes for the other girls to their boyfriends in the other cabins, and they'd pay me a quarter.
Oh my gosh.
Because I knew how to say you're cute or whatever the right way. And so they would say, could you write it? And what should I do? And they'd pay me a quarter. So I guess I got corrupted all the way back
then. Right.
But my own parents were in a painful relationship and a divorce. I was a very introspective child. I was very serious. I've always been serious. I mean, I never.
No, you're not. You're not serious now.
So I was never into. So I'm really practicing lightening up. I never was into things that were artificial or superficial at all. I mean, I had some sense of destiny from the time I was young. And for a while, I thought that destiny was going to be just being hurt one time after another.
Yeah.
I had a few early relationships that were very unhappy and decided when I was 18 to go on a spiritual path because I wanted some answers. I wanted to know why I was here, what life was about, what my purpose was, and I really didn't understand the things I saw around me and in my own life. At that point, I began practicing meditation, TM, became a TM teacher, dropped out of life, lived in Europe,
wow.
Meditated for years at a time.
Traveled with Maharishi.
That's right.
You're on a roll.
And then taught TM all over the country for several years. If you had said to me then, as I was wearing skirts, you know, down to my ankles because they were modest. If you'd said to me then, you're going to be a best-selling author, or I would have
talking about sex explicitly,
absolutely
too.
Never, ever believed it. I mean, I had a real selfless kind of understanding of what I was here to do, but I really believed in peace on earth. I believed in making a difference. I grew up in the 60s. I bought all that stuff. I marched in the peace marches. And when everyone else forgot about it in the 70s, I didn't. I thought, wait a minute. I mean, I liked that stuff. So when I guess, I was about 26 years old, I had this great spiritual development and this wonderful relationship with God and terrible relationships with men. And I thought, there's something a little out of balance here. So when I got divorced, and at that time I was married to a magician, Doug Henning, who was a celebrity and
yes.
used to saw me in half and chop me up and stuff like that. Magical abuse. I decided it's time for me to really go on a different path. And so I began taking seminars and I went into therapy and again, with no interest, but just to save myself and got led back onto the path that I originally had started on really when I was a child and got back my master's degree, got my PhD. And again, at the time, still really had no idea what I was going to do. I did not start the career I'm in now until I was 30.
Wow.
And when people call me up and say, gee, I don't know what I want to do with my life, I'm 24, I say, oh, you got years left to figure it out. We're not all like you, Tony, you know? Some of us take a while to figure out our dharma. So I began at that point. I just gave a seminar in my living room for 18 people. And I didn't really even know what I was doing, but I knew that by teaching, I opened myself up to a level of wisdom that came through me, and I became one of my own students,
right.
And that it just felt right to me. And literally everything just exploded from that point on. Not overnight, but slowly and steadily and consistently until it's where it is now. And I have a hard time really receiving and accepting the level of success that I've achieved. I'm still...
You'll get used to
that
it.
Little... Oh, thank you. I'll quote you on that in the future. But and I think it's because I never set out to be famous. I never set out to have money. I never set out to even be successful. I set out to learn and to grow myself. And that really is still my main motivation. And so the greatest moments in my life are not when my agent calls me and says, we just got a 7-figure contract or whatever. It's when I get to a new understanding with somebody or I learn something. That still is the thing that gives me the most pleasure. And I hope it always will be.
What's great about that is you get those pleasures every day. You might get a book contract once a year, but you get to do these things once a day. So you're setting yourself up to win. I'm curious, everybody seems to want love. It's the major issue. There are a few subjects that grab people, you know, love, sex, food, money, a few things, but all these people, all of us in the world seem to want love so badly, and yet so few people experience it. Tell me why.
We weren't taught how to love one another. We weren't taught how to love ourselves. We have terrible models. It would be like growing up with parents who crashed the car every 5 minutes because they never knew where the brakes were, they didn't know where the accelerator was, and so you go out and you get your first car, and of course you total it. Well, most of us grew up in families where we learned very bad examples of how to communicate, how to ask, how to give, and according to most people, when I ask my audiences how many of you would like to have a relationship just like your parents, everyone just starts to laugh. You know, once in a while, a lone person raises their hand, but most of us wouldn't, and yet, and you know this because you teach about programming, you know, by the time we're 8 years old, we are almost entirely programmed, and right. Most of what we are programmed with is how to shut down, how to deny, how to not tell the truth, how to not be in touch with our feelings, and how to not trust. And based on that, we grow up and go out and expect to have these wonderful relationships with someone else who doesn't know how to trust and is in denial.
Has no references on how to make it work.
Right. And our intention to love is not enough. We really have been so poorly trained. And some people say, but what about my parents or my grandparents? They didn't seem to have the troubles that this generation does. That's true. However, our desires were very different. My grandmother did not care about sharing power. She didn't care about intimacy. She wanted to make sure there was food. Maybe if they had enough money, they'd get a car. And if she was lucky, her kids would actually go on to college. That was success for a marriage. We are in a very different time, economically and socially. So we have much higher standards. Our desires have quadrupled. Our skills have stayed the same. So I see what I'm doing, of course, what you're doing, is filling in that gap for people. Our abilities are back in the 1800s. We need to catch up with technologies such as the ones that we both share with people so that we can start living the life that we really deserve to live. But we're not going to just do it by being born and saying, I want to have a good relationship. Unfortunately, it's not enough.
Well, one of the things I love in both your books, I'm really impressed by, I think that most people take one route or another in teaching. They either teach philosophy, general beliefs about how things work, or they teach strategies. And my own personal belief is you got to have both. And I think you've done an excellent job in that. Let's take one of them. I read them both last night, the 4 o'clock in the morning. I was really impressed. I was sharing some of the information.
And isn't your relationship better today?
It already is. I talked to my wife about it. Actually, I talked to my wife about it right before I left. But how to make love all the time. What a great title. There are a lot of things in here. Why don't you just clarify, what do you mean by making love all the time?
I really believe that the experience of being in love, in the state of love, is a possibility. In fact, is really the goal for a relationship. And that most of us limit those high moments of connection to sex or to our anniversary, and that you can be in love and feel like you are making love, literally, right, with your partner all the time. And that the myth that, well, you, after 5 years, you lose the magic, and of course you don't feel passionate, and what do you expect? You have 3 children. That even though it is common that we see that, it is not normal.
Right.
People say to me, but isn't it normal? I mean, doesn't that happen to most marriages? And I say, yes, and that's because it's common. But I don't think it's normal. I think it is normal if you love someone today to love them more in 20 years, not less. But the way we erode relationships by making mistakes, which I mention in the book, By the time we get to 5 years, we're lucky if we're even speaking to one another anymore. So I wrote the book, in a sense, like Relationships 101, as a manual for what goes wrong, what can make it work, what to avoid, the basics that I wish was taught in high school, in junior high school. These days, elementary school, probably.
Let's talk about some of the mistakes then. What are some of the biggest mistakes that people make in relationships? I know there's one common theme that struck me really strongly, but what's been the most important distinctions? What have they been that you've made over the years working with all these people that are the mistakes that we've got to avoid in order to make relationships work at the highest level?
I think two things come to mind. The first, many people are never in the relationship. I don't care if they've been married 40 years, they have never committed themselves to really being in the relationship. They exist in a relationship coexisting with another person. But if things aren't going their way, they leave. They literally psychically leave or energetically leave that relationship for 10 minutes. They abandon the marriage. And I see couples all the time who have never really committed, no matter what, to working on that relationship. I get calls on the radio, every other call. We have a problem, my husband doesn't want to talk about it. Well, what are you doing married if you don't want to talk about it? But this is just rampant. So that's the first thing. Once you're in it, it is absolutely not telling the complete truth to your partner. That includes many things. Asking for what you want, which means you have to know what you want. Letting the resentments and the little problems build up, pushing them down so you don't rock the boat, numbing yourself to them, and that definitely erodes the passion between two people. And not telling the truth about the anger, about the fears, so that your reality remains separate. Intimacy Right. is a shared experience of reality. And if you're not sharing your reality with your partners, even if it's a guy who says, you know what, my inventory's down at work and we're not making enough sales this month and I'm scared to death, that's something your wife needs to know. If she doesn't, you are not sharing a piece of yourself, and you're going to find yourself 3 months down the line not wanting to make love to her, and you won't even think it has to do with what's going at work, but it does.
So it's in other words, it's creating the separation but not sharing fully.
Yes, it's building a wall, an emotional wall that we can feel, but we don't understand where it came from. And some people think a wall is, well, I had an affair and I didn't tell her. But it's the little things that are more insidious. Not asking for what you want. Not letting somebody know that you're not feeling as appreciated as you need to be. It's one brick and another brick and another brick. And then you wake up one day and you look at your partner in the morning and you have that sinking feeling. You know, I love him, but I'm not in love anymore. Where did the magic go? And you really don't know. And it's not that it went. It is buried under Right. piles of withheld communications and resentments. The good news is you can create that again. I've seen it happen. I see it happen in my seminars all the time. It's like a miracle. People who were ready to get divorced, who hadn't slept together in 5 years, 2 days, and they are in love again. That's the power of renewal of the human heart.
Without a doubt. Let's go back for a second, talking about, usually relationships don't die overnight, which is what a lot of people think. They think there's one threshold experience and it's over. And I'm sure that things can build to a threshold. But one of the things that I really thought was valuable were, you talked about the four R's in your book
yes.
here. And I thought what was brilliant about that is the order in which they happen. And I have a philosophy that we teach in our seminars, and that's kill the monster while it's little. And maybe you can amplify a little bit about the four R's and what kind of role they play, not only in a personal relationship, but also with maybe your kids and other people as well.
Absolutely. I wish someone had told me about these years ago. The four R's are the four stages of the destruction of intimacy, whether it's with your partner, your business partner, your office staff, your children. And they are resistance, resentment, rejection, and repression, number four. Resistance is normal. It's little things. You know, he leaves his towels on the floor. She talks on the phone too much. That's normal. You are going to feel little resistances with anyone who's human and who's different from you. The problem is what we do with those feelings of resistance. We don't talk about them. We gloss them over. We push them down. We deny them because we don't want to stir things up. The more they build up, and the more we push them down, at some point, they turn into resentments. You know, instead of saying, gee, I wish he wouldn't tell that same story at the party every time he go out. Now it's, I hate that story. If he tells it one more time, I'm going to kill him. So now you are being very re-stimulated. Now you are right. having a reaction, and it has built up to a point where you are triggered a lot.
Right.
In the second stage resentment, you are starting to feel a wall between you. Your sex life definitely is beginning to deteriorate. You will say it's because you're tired or you don't have time for each other. But you remember when you first met that you always found the time for each other. You're feeling little criticisms of one another. If you're the silent type, you don't say any of this out loud. But you're just feeling a little distant. And again, Most people don't do anything about it. They push it down. They try even more to look like things are okay. And then things turn into stage three because the tension has built to the point where now you are not just feeling resentment, you are feeling rejection. You are protecting yourself. You put up a wall between you and this other person. This is in a relationship where you're having definite sexual problems or lack of desire. You are either having an affair, thinking about it, or just leading very separate lives. We don't see each other much, but everything's fine. When you're in a relationship with friends or business associates, you think of them and you get a terrible feeling inside your body. This stage can go in one of two directions. Either that is when the relationship ends, you get divorced, you leave, you break up your partnership, or you do what most healthy Americans do, which is go into major denial, push it all down so that you make peace, and you go into stage four, which is repression, and you repress it, and you say everything's fine. I love him. I'm not in love anymore, but everything's fine. We went through a rough period for a while, but we never fight. We never argue. Of course, we have no magic. We have no connection. We have no chemistry.
Which is the most dangerous stage to be in of all.
It's the most dangerous stage. It's the stage, you know, it is denial. Most American couples I see walk around in this stage. A lot of our parents lived in this stage.
And usually people don't, what will push people out of denial because they don't have it, they're disassociating from their pain so much, it doesn't seem like they have much motivation to change.
They have no motivation to change. The lack of passion affects everything else in their life because if you're repressing, you're repressing. You repress your passion for everything. And it's pretty hard to go out and be 100% motivated doing something else when you're using so much energy to keep in all that anger.
Right.
And in this stage, either you stay that way and really get into a lot of emotional numbness, which is a disease, or something triggers it and it blows up. And this is the couple you hear about, Tony, who seem to be so happy. I can't believe they're getting divorced. I never even saw them fight. They seem so in love. Of course, I always say there's two stages after that, revenge and retardation, but we're not going to talk about those right now. And the good news, the good news is you can go back from repression and recreate your relationship, but it means telling the complete truth about every one of those things that is stored up. And the real scary thing is we go through those four stages, I'd say 20 or 30 times a day. Some little thing bothers you and you go, no big deal, don't worry about it. That whole thing took, what, 10 seconds in my mind, right?
Exactly.
And we do that enough times, and we are in the habit of repressing. And we don't realize it when we wake up, and we're wondering why we don't feel connected, not just to our partner, but to life, to our own passion, to our own dreams, because we don't pay attention to that inner world and the wonderful signals that our heart gives us that something is not right.
So we should be sensitive to that kind of tension. Then when we feel that initial tension, we should handle it as quickly as we possibly can.
Absolutely. I call it using an emotional Geiger counter, like those people on the beach looking for jewels and gold with those little sticks, you know.
That's great.
We feel tense, I mean, you're driving home in your car and you notice you're just feeling tense. Well, most people at that point either turn the radio on, go home and have some Häagen-Dazs, go to sleep, or have a fight with their wife. They never say, why am I feeling tense? What's bothering me? And take the time to do an emotional exploration and really figure out what it is. It makes sense to me.
It does. I think one of the neat distinctions you followed it up with in the book that really struck me was, and it's so simple, but I never thought of it this way, is the concept that you can't be passionate or you're not going to feel attracted or passionate to somebody that you're angry with. And while that seems so simple to me, it just struck me in the head and I thought, that's interesting. Yeah, if I'm feeling angry towards this person, of course I'm not going to be in an attracted mode. And if you're not aware you're angry, that's the most dangerous stage of all. So how does a person, well, let's talk about direct and open and complete communication, as you talk about, full disclosure, if you will. A lot of people would argue with you and say, but isn't there a time for that? Now, I know that can be a great rationalization for never handling it and building stuff up, but how do you balance that out, you know, between somebody's in the middle of something and saying, we got to talk, and it's an inappropriate time, and what it does is the person really won't hear you because they're in such an aggravated state about the timing. How do you deal with that when you're talking with people?
Obviously, there's a time and a place to talk to people, but it's going to be within a few hours of the problem. It's not going to be in 3 weeks when the kids go to school or whatever excuses we make. If you notice you're upset, the first thing is for you to get in touch with what's really bothering you, because most of us just end up doing emotional dumping on one another, and I call it telling the incomplete truth. You know, I was at a party with my boyfriend, and he didn't include me in a conversation, and so I think I'm angry. And I say to him, you know what, I want to tell you the truth, and I've taken all these seminars, and they say, tell your feelings, you jerk, you didn't include me, you're, you know, I can't stand you, I'm furious, and now I feel so much better. Don't you?
No,
you know?
I don't.
and so you think, well, I learn all these things, I read, tell the truth, why doesn't it make me feel good? because we're not telling the complete truth. Anger is the tip of the iceberg. It's the warning sign. It's the most crude level of
disturbance. Well, doesn't it usually come from being hurt?
Absolutely. It hurts. Hurt and sadness is underneath that. Underneath that is fear and vulnerability. That little kid inside of us felt really upset. And once we get down to that, then we can look at the big picture. Then we can see what we did wrong, what they did wrong, what we need, what we want. And of course, underneath it all is the love. I mean, if I didn't love you, I wouldn't be hurt by that thing you said to me. Now, that's the complete truth. And it's so much easier to hear when you tell somebody all of it and not just dumping the anger on them. And that's the problem I see with a lot of communication and communication workshops, is they get people to scream and yell at each other, and everyone feels very emotionally damaged and battered. And it's not complete. It's really not complete.
It actually creates another conditioning process as well, because I've watched this happen.
Right.
Here I am telling you all things I'm upset about, and initially I don't have that much feeling, but boy, once I start unloading, and I'm looking at your face while I'm feeling this, and pretty soon when I look at your face, I'm talking about other subjects, I feel those emotions.
Mm-hmm.
We call it anchoring. And vice versa, if I'm dumping on you and you're looking at my face being angry about how I'm dumping on you, all we're creating is more and more resentment. So from your standpoint, if a couple's gone through threshold, if they're in a position where they really don't feel like they're in love any longer, and there's a desire on either person's part to try and reignite it, put it back together, what are the first steps? What would you tell them to do?
The first thing is for them each to take an accounting of all the things that they are holding inside that are not balanced and not okay. All the things that they've been angry about and hurt about, to use some of the techniques I mentioned, love letters, where they really get to figure out what they're feeling. Once they know not just what they think is bothering them, but what is really bothering them, because I always say people never fight for the reasons they think they're fighting. You know, people come to me and say, we're fighting about the kids and we're fighting about the house. You're fighting because you don't feel loved and you don't feel understood. That is the reason we fight.
Sure.
And if you don't understand that, you could sit there and talk about the kids for the next 5 years and never get anywhere. So first you need to do an exploration so you can get in touch with that little kid inside of you that really needs to say, you know what, honey? You know, I need more attention from you. I'm lonely. I miss you.
So let me tie you down. How do they do that? Do they take out a piece of paper and pencil, do it? They sit down with their partner and just do a stream of consciousness? What's the best way to go about it?
The best way first is to do it yourself, so that you're not going to be interrupted by somebody else's reactions, as you said, and interrupt your process. And write what I call a love letter, and start out with the anger and go all the way down until you feel the love, until you feel really clear. And hopefully your partner can do the same thing. And then you give it to that person and you read it out loud and they read it back. And you start to understand what's going on inside the other person. And you start to understand what's going on inside of you. And that understanding is what begins to recreate the intimacy. I've really found that people can go through just about anything and recover from just about anything in relationship if they can recreate the intimacy. Because the truth is, on one level, we could be intimate and fall in love with anybody. I mean, if someone put...
And most of us have proven it.
Yes, exactly. Well, I certainly have. I mean, you could put, you know, two people on a desert island, and if there were no one else there, they would fall in love. I mean, the human beings have such divinity inside of them that when you transcend all the extraneous stuff, you feel the spirit and you feel yours, and that is the feeling of being in love. You feel love. And I really believe that if couples learn how to get this other stuff out of the way, they can repair. They can repair.
How can they prevent it from ever getting that place in the first place?
Well, number one, if anyone who's listening to this is getting involved in a relationship and has had failed relationships in the past, don't be so innocent to think that just because you're with a new person, you're not going to make the same mistakes again.
Or you moved to Tennessee.
No, exactly. That was my radio show today. That means get some education. Read every book you can. Take every relationship seminar you can. Listen to tapes. You know, sit down together and say, I want to come into this with some different input. You can't just expect that it's going to change by itself. It won't. In fact, it's going to get worse because now you have another set of negative experiences.
More baggage for you.
And your trust level is lower. So unless you've had some extensive relationship education, go out and get it. And don't feel like you're a failure getting it. You're a pioneer. You're somebody who wants excellence. You're not going to settle for a mediocre, boring relationship like most of us are frightened we're going to have.
Right. Well, I think one of the major things, the themes that comes through in both of your books over and over again is that how you make relationships better is you make them a priority. And I'm a big believer in what I call concentration of power, that whatever you focus on consistently and every day it's got to be better, it will be better, whatever that is.
Absolutely. Human beings, our attention and intelligence is so vast, and our ability to empower things with our attention is so fantastic. And most of us only pay attention to our relationships when they are in crisis. And wait until either, you know, our partner's calling the lawyer, or we're having a big fight, or it's been a month since we've had sex, and then we start talking about it. And the truth is, if your child had even a sniffle, you'd be running over there. You know, if your business showed a tiny deficit, you'd be taking care of it. You wouldn't wait till the creditors came to the door with the red slips.
Well, I don't know. I think a lot of people do. That's the unfortunate part of a lot of people's businesses. But yes, I hear you.
So it means really understanding that if you want lifelong passion, you're going to have to invest in it, not 24 hours a day, but even 10 quality minutes a day, which most people don't have. I interview women and say, when's the last time your husband gave you a real kiss? Not a peck, but a real kiss. And I see women saying, let's see, last Monday, I guess it was about 2 weeks ago. I mean, that's tragic. That's tragic. That's why I invented the 20-second kiss, so they could at least get in a few of those a day.
Okay. Let's cut to the quick. What do men want? What do women want? They both want love, but it seems like as a generalization, and no matter what we do, we got to be careful. We create generalizations when we write books, when we talk about it, especially people who listen to us. But there are some generalizations that are useful as guides. Where do you see the differences in men and women's rules, I guess, and how to meet those needs?
The first thing I think people need to understand is we are in a cross-cultural situation right now. We are from different planets. We have been brought up and socialized so differently over the last few thousand years. And I'll tell you something, Tony, it's taken me years to really accept this, because coming from a spiritual background, I did not want to really acknowledge how true this was until I got in trouble in one relationship after another, and I finally started really talking to men and asking them questions and hearing the same things from them over and over again. And I had to put my pride aside and say, yes, there are big differences. And unless we acknowledge and understand those differences, we are going to be in trouble. I mean, I'm going to be sitting here speaking in Spanish saying, why don't you understand me? You're going to be answering in Italian saying, why don't you understand me? And we're not willing to learn each other's language. So that's one of the reasons I wrote the second book, Secrets About Men, for myself, number one, because I did not understand a male way of thinking. And yes, I don't like to generalize either, but I had enough experiences repetitively to think, gee, you know, there have to be
some a certain way to open
here.
A door, right?
Definitely. We have to also have some compassion. I mean, women are in such a transitional time. It is the first time in the history of our sex from the beginning of time when we have had the freedoms that we have now up until really 70 years ago. I mean, women couldn't even vote at the beginning of the century. Up until very recently, we were not even seen as equal. Women having a job that was just unheard of. An unmarried woman over 22, my gosh, something must be wrong with you. So we are playing by new rules that nobody has modeled for us. No one. How to balance family, career, softness, power. No one knows how to do it. I know I made the mistake most women do when I began to get into the personal growth field and become a teacher and a lecturer. I looked to the role models so I could go out there and be a great speaker, and I model myself after the best man I could find. And and that's because that's who was out there.
Right.
And there were very few women who were there for younger women to look at and say, I want to be like her, or I would like to have her style. And so there was a whole group of women who kind of became the tough, you know, kind of pushy types, because we were modeling ourselves after Werner Erhard or whoever was there.
Right.
We, not consciously, but we just did. So women are in a real challenging time of how to continue to stay in touch with their femininity and yet express their power and integrate it all. And men are in a very perplexing time, because they have been used to women being one way for thousands of years. And all of a sudden, women...
And they're mad saying, God, what are you doing changing the rules on me?
They're changing the rules, but we don't even know what we want the rules to change to yet, so we're not real consistent. You know, how many men have stood up in a seminar and said, if I hear another woman say she wants a sensitive, open, vulnerable man, and the next time I open up and start to cry, she says, oh, I'm scared, you're so wimpy. And I hear this all the time. And it's true. We have a double standard. We're imposing it on men. Men hate it. Men hate having us judge them for how much money they make, as much as women hate being judged for their bodies. And how many women meet a wonderful, sensitive, open, conscious, spiritually evolved guy?
You say, Mom, he's a secretary.
That's right. He works in a shoe store, and she has a hard time with that. Because she wants him to do that, but she wants the Porsche, and she wants the high executive position. And we are all in a muddle. It's going to continue, I think, for several decades.
Well, you're really encouraging.
Well, it's, you know, all great, I mean, you know, this all great times of transformation have to come out of chaos, whether it's in our bodies, in an, you know, healing crisis, or in a marriage, or in society. Hopefully it's not too bad, but I see all the signs of a major crisis, and I am excited about it because it means that we are really making significant changes.
I agree. Well, out of chaos, new patterns always emerge. The question is, for those who don't want to wait until it resolves and want to resolve it in their own relationships now, tell me, what are the most important things that a man needs to know about women? Let me turn the book on you a little bit, because the secrets women need to know about men. What's the opposite of that question? What do men need to know about women in order to really make their relationships work? What are some of the most important things that you think they should know?
The smallest things make women happy. We are so easy to please. I know men are saying, are you kidding? Nothing I do ever pleases her.
I can see their faces now.
But the smallest things, women all have a little girl inside of them that wants to feel adored and special and taken care of and that you're thinking of her. Men get very focused, and women tend to not understand this and think that they are being ignored. A few phone calls during the day saying, I'm thinking of you. I mean, she's going to go in this one for months. Months! She'll be waiting at the door when you get home. Letting her into your inner world. Men are very protective and internalize their feelings. And again, they've been taught that. Women talk out loud and we externalize a lot. So we think you're withholding when you don't tell us what's happening. And we say, what's wrong? And you say nothing. We think you're lying. We don't realize that what he means by nothing is nothing that you need to know about right now. I'm still trying to figure it out myself. Women need to know your process, men. We don't care if it's perfect. We don't care if you figured it out. We don't care if you have an answer. We just want to know you and feel you and have you let us make a difference in your life. Women are the creative force. We want to make a difference. We want to make things better. Women are improvers. You know, they'll go in and say, oh, honey, your hair is just a little bit like this. And if you put a flowers in the house, it would look prettier. So we want to know that we're making a difference for you.
Men, though, have been conditioned to, is it not true,
that
they're supposed
anybody.
To be perfect already?
I don't need anybody.
Exactly.
I don't need you. I'm wimpy. So our differences are absolutely in opposition. And that's where we get into power struggles in the relationship. I want to know I just make a difference to you. I want to know what I said means something. I want to know that seeing me is lightening up your day. You want me to think that you're so strong and independent that I can count on you. But I don't want to count on you being invulnerable. I want to count on the fact that you need me so that I feel I have value as well.
So you want to count on the intimacy.
Absolutely.
The connection.
Absolutely. And if I hear, again, women complaining about making love and sex, and we can throw some sex into this tape here, women all say the same thing. You know, men think that they're supposed to figure out, you know, what button to push and, you know, where the G-spot is
right.
And all this stuff. Women just want to be adored. Most foreplay is from the neck up. It's psychological. You sit there and tell her how much you love her, believe me, she'll go for a quickie. You know, you sit there and try to do the perfect things for 20 minutes and she's so bored. She goes, oh my God, you know, isn't he going to get it? And worshiping a woman, you know, emotionally is going to just get you so much farther than trying to be the perfect technician. And women hate it and they talk about it behind men's backs all the time.
Interesting. Well, what's the reverse then? What is it that women need to know about men to make the relationship work at the highest level?
Women need to know that men need so much approval and acknowledgement, 25 times more than we think they do. If he shows you that he doesn't need it, he needs it 50 times more. Men all have a scared little boy inside that wants to be good and doesn't want to make mistakes and wants to do it right. And if a man even thinks you're saying he's doing it wrong, he's going to have a very strong subliminal reaction. And it looks like he's being defensive, but he just wants to look good. Men have been trained to look good. So teaching a man that you love him even when he doesn't look good is so important. Never making men feel like you are collecting evidence against them. Men hate the fact that women have a memory that goes back as far as the beginning of time. They say, well, you know, 5 years ago once when you did this,
but
they
don't
hate
men,
it.
But wait a second, but don't men do that too?
No, not anywhere near as much as women.
Really?
Not anywhere near as much as women. Women like to be, you know, the librarians of relationships, you know, and have a list. And that's because we have felt powerless to ask for what we want. So we have to kind of have evidence against somebody else. I think women also need to understand that men need to be told and supported in the fact that they are working on their process, that they're not going to be as emotionally articulate as women. They're not going to be as easy to talk to as your girlfriend. It's just never going to happen. They have thousands of years of catching up to do in that element. We've been taught to do that since we were little girls. Men are learning to unlearn the things that they were taught. So if a man's sitting there and he's not quite saying it right, don't rush him. Listen, give him the time to get it out. Give him a few hours to think about it. Give him till the next day. Instead of sitting there saying, come on, come on, what are you trying to say to me? I don't understand what you're saying. They'll say, never mind. And they'll shut down. It's taken me a long time to learn this.
So it sounds like one of the number one keys, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, is to make sure that you never get in that shutdown stage in the first place. That if you see that, that's the thing to interrupt immediately.
Absolutely. And to let, you know, men have felt so battered in the last 10 years. I mean, I know women's rights and all of that stuff. I agree with it all. But because we've come out and tried to gain our power again, men have really felt that we are in a men are jerks era. It must be my fault. That men are the bad guys, and if they could change, everything would be fine.
And the best-selling books tend to go in that direction,
right.
Don't they?
That's the reason.
Why men are jerks? But you didn't write that here. I want to acknowledge you.
And that's one of the reasons that I think it became a bestseller is because there was such a need for this. More men bought this book than have bought any best-selling book about relationships in a long time, according to the research. And one of the things, and I get letters from men every day saying, thank you for understanding me. So I always say to women, if you want a man to change, show him you understand him. He will be much more apt to change than when you condemn him and say, change, because I don't like the way you are. Let him know you understand how difficult it is for him. Let him know you understand why he's that way. He's not just trying to be a jerk. And it makes a big difference.
Let's talk about sex.
I knew you'd get to that.
Yeah, you wanted me to. You've been begging me all along here.
At least you didn't rush right into it.
Well, let's cut right to the core here. What is the difference in what men and women want sexually? You've kind of touched on it already from the standpoint of that women really want to be worshipped and it starts in the mind.
But I'll tell you, men want sex and women want making love. There's no doubt about it.
So tell me, the difference from your perspective.
This is a big difference between us, and this one is going to take a lot of flexibility. Men are ready in 1 minute, and they could be over in 1 minute, and they're completely happy on one level.
Why?
Because their physiology is that way. They are. I mean, a man will get aroused in, you know, I forget what it is, 45 seconds or something like that, and be completely ready for intercourse.
You've been doing this with a stopwatch, Barbara.
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Whereas women take much, much longer to even physiologically get prepared for intercourse. So right there, we have a problem.
And who set the system up? Sounds like torture.
I don't know. If I could talk to him, I'd make him go through the seminar. So the problem is that women and men are at going through a very different pace. The other thing is that sex is a very different function for men and women. For men, sex is a tremendous form of release. For women, it is an opportunity to become physically and emotionally intimate. So many times we're going into it with very different agendas. There was a study recently, I don't know what magazine it was in, that said that women, if they had a choice between intercourse and cuddling, would take cuddling, 75% of them. And one of the reasons is not that they don't want sex, but that they really miss that affection.
Right.
So I'm just throwing these in. These are some of the problems that we have with it.
One of the things you said, though, that I would tend to agree with in the book was that I think that men relate sex as to being a total acceptance and love, whereas women can feel that without sex. Is that an accurate estimation of what you believe?
It is. And you have to think of the physiology. I mean, you can't understand each other completely. Women are so vulnerable. You are entering inside of them. It is. You can feel somebody inside your body. Men don't know it. Most men, anyway, don't know what that's like. Man, on the other hand, his sexuality is very exposed. There is a sense, I mean, when he's turned on, you know it. A woman, you can never know. Men cannot fake orgasms. Women can. So there's a sense of vulnerability.
As they proved in Harry Met Sally.
That's right. There's a sense of real exposure with a man,
right,
and a sense of real vulnerability with a woman. And again, understanding those two things helps you to take that sexual experience and focus it where I really think it should go, which is into an emotional and eventually a spiritual experience of union. But you have to kind of start where you are and understand that sex is the most powerful time of energetic union that we experience. For that reason, it has the potential, I think, to take us to incredible heights of ecstasy. It also has the potential to create more pain than just about anything else we do to one another.
And we see that day in and day out. One of the things that you said that I thought was real interesting about that was you said one of your strategies, I believe, was to women anyway, was to have sex with your husband more often or your boyfriend more often, and he'll make love to you more often. Can you clarify what you mean
Absolutely.
By that?
Absolutely. And I, again, I've learned this, you know, the hard way. Most women's idea of the perfect lovemaking experience starts out with, you know, a half hour of dancing and a dinner and, you know, slow, long undressing and this long, drawn out foreplay and then this, you know, intercourse. And that takes, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours or something like that, which most couples who are busy and have kids absolutely don't have. At least they don't have it once a week. If they have it once a month, they're lucky. So many times we get into an all or nothing pattern. If we don't really have time to do everything, we end up doing nothing. We wake up in the morning, the kids are still sleeping or they're just stirring. We have about 15 minutes before we really have to get out of bed and you start hugging your partner. You kind of get turned on and you say, look at the watch, say, honey, you know, we better go, just make breakfast. Because in a woman's mind, a quickie's out. A quickie is just completely out because it makes her dirty. It means it's not going to perhaps be as satisfying to her. And somehow she feels used. But I always tell women, if you can really appreciate the value of that kind of physical communion and surrender with your partner, if you can really see it for what it is, which is a time to just feel one another. It may not be the perfect sexual experience, but it is a moment of union. Not only will you have more of an erotic connection the rest of the week, you'll create the time for that long period, and your partner will feel that you understand his needs a little bit more, so when it comes time to switch into a little more sensitive mode, he'll be more willing to do that.
So if you want to get, you should give first.
That's right.
I see. Very good. Let's talk about you for a second. What have you learned that have enhanced your relationship? You've learned a lot of things, but one of the things I do respect about you from my experience of you is that you really live what you talk about. So what's one of the most important distinctions you've learned? And you've had some challenging relationships like most of us have, but it seems like you've got something going on really well now, something you're really happy about with your boyfriend. So tell me, what are you using right now in your own life that makes a difference there?
I have made every mistake I've written about in my book, Secrets About Men. I literally reread that book over and over again. I have to follow all the rules in there because I have done everything that I tell women not to do. I've given up my power to men. I've mothered them. I've sacrificed who I was in relationship with them. I've, you know, acted like a little girl and not really shown my strength. I've done everything. And I didn't do it because I was being anything but what I thought was very loving. I was trying to be the most loving woman I could be. And unfortunately, what many of us are taught about being loving is how to be powerless as a woman. So I have, and people are always surprised when they hear this because they see me on TV or they hear me on the radio, they say, you've done these things? And they're kind of shocked, but they're also relieved because they figure if somebody as, quote, powerful as I am, at least as they see that I am, could make these mistakes, then there's hope for them. And I really feel that way. My personal life and my professional life were so far apart, it wasn't funny. I mean, I just absolutely was a wimp in my relationships. I let myself be mistreated. I let myself not be loved enough. And again, all in the name of being accepting and patient and understanding his point of view to the point where I lost myself.
And you're not attractive to a man in that mode anyway.
Absolutely not. And then
no man wants a weak woman.
And then when he goes out and cheats on you, you say, what did I do wrong? I loved you so much. What else could I have done? Who could love you more than me? That used to be my big thing. As they walked out the door with someone else, no one will love you as much as I do. And you know what? Now I say, hopefully, you know, hopefully a healthy person will not love you as much as I did, because what I was doing a lot of times was not loving them. I was, at the expense of loving myself, giving myself over to them. And it wasn't really loving them. It was sacrificing. It was trying to buy their love with being the perfect little girl or the perfect lover. And that was a very hard lesson for me to learn. It is a very fresh lesson. It's just been in the last few years that I really faced it and looked at my own codependency, which I did not want to see. And the result has been I am in the healthiest, most fulfilling, balanced relationship I've ever been in. I'm also not married to him, which is a difference for me. I used to just marry whoever I was with. I mean, that was what I did. So I'm doing everything very differently.
And you're getting different results.
I'm getting very different results. I'm reprogramming myself every day. It's new for me.
Talk about that. What do you do each day to increase the intimacy? Because I know you're not going to be satisfied with it just being as great as it was yesterday.
Never. Never.
So I can identify.
I'm a love glutton. Never.
Well, what do you do to amplify it every day to make it more?
We always take time, you know, however long it is, to talk about everything that happened during the day. I mean, we just, you know, he just complains about everything and he runs through whatever happened, and he's a chiropractor, and I'll talk about people at work and my radio show, and we just hold each other and listen and are there to kind of kiss away the bumps and the bruises. And that, in a sense, lets us feel somebody loves you and accepts you for exactly who you are. We clean up things as soon as they come up, and the time is shrinking as we speak. Even with us, it's shrinking. We both have been trying to learn to acknowledge our own needs, which, you know, luckily or unluckily, I found somebody who's been just as giving as I am. So at first I thought it was great, right, until he informed me a year into the relationship that he wasn't meeting his own needs. I thought, right, oh, shucks, I just thought he was Mr. Perfect, you know? He just was at my beck and call.
He is Mr. Perfect. He communicated it.
That's right. So we're both learning to say, no, I don't want to do that, or no, I need some time by myself, or whatever it is. And most of all, seeing that the other person doesn't run away, that they're still there, learning to be able to be angry and have the person still say, I love you. I mean, I am just reprogramming myself every minute in this relationship. It is like, it's the best seminar I've ever been in. And the biggest challenge for me has been trusting what I'm experiencing, because my reality has been, it's good for a while, and then somebody's going to leave or hurt me or abandon me.
So that was the old belief. What's the new belief that empowers you?
The new belief is that I deserve to be totally loved and adored, even when I'm not perfect, and that I can create the kind of relationship I want that gets better and better every day.
And what references do you use to make that real for yourself?
I look at, you're the expert in repro, I should probably have you tap me and have me look, roll my eyes a little bit. I'm trying everything I can get. Every time I start to feel lost in that other belief, I have a reality check with him. You know, I mean, I'll give you an example. He went to a chiropractic conference last weekend, and my experience has been, man goes out of town, man cheats on woman. That started with my father and went all the way through my relationships. So before he even went, months before he announced the conference, and I noticed I had a physical reaction. I didn't know what it was. We got closer to it, and I was having the same reaction. So I looked in, I found the source, an old program, and I talked to him about it. And I said, I have this reality that you're going to go out of town and cheat on me. No information at all that would lead me to think that would happen. He's the most faithful guy in the world. But that has been my experience. And so he was good enough to talk about, you know, why I'd thought that in the past, what clues I had, how my relationships had not been good before they'd left, and helped me really retrain my mind to pick up different cues. He called me every 5 minutes when he was there. He came back, we had a fabulous reunion, and next time he leaves, I will have, you know,
a new reference experience.
I have a new reference experience.
But it's still there. You still have the old ones as well.
And that's the case. I tell people this all the time, that if you've had painful experiences, the only thing to balance them out, in my opinion, is positive experiences. And your mind has a new reference point. So create the positive experiences. So it takes time. And sometimes I think we need to act in spite of our old reference points and know that time will heal it. It doesn't take the equal amount of time, because I'm more conscious now. But there's always going to be, you know, a little girl looking for evidence that she's about to be abandoned. And I know her, and I know how to talk to her. I know how to give her evidence that that's not happening, and regain her trust, which is really what it's about.
How do you deal with what's happening now in your life, which is all the good you're giving to other people is coming back to you in a variety of avenues, and fame and fortune, and a chance to really have the impact that I think you've probably always been committed to. And with that comes this one resource that seems to be the only limit you have. You don't have it in enthusiasm or energy or intelligence or commitment.
Are you talking about time?
That's right, time. How do you deal with that? Because so many people talk about, and they ask me the question all the time, I mean, how do you have 4 kids, a wife, have this incredible relationship, go out and do all these things?
It's a very exciting and scary time. I've been saying scary a lot, and my boyfriend keeps saying exciting. Change it to exciting, because
he's right.
there is so much energy. I feel like a vortex, you know, like kind of happens. I feel everywhere I go right now, I make things happen. I mean, I'm not even doing it consciously. There is so much energy that has built up around me. I mean, good deeds, and I believe in all that spiritual stuff. And
yes.
It is happening. It is just happening. It is not in my control at this point. Things are coming in.
You're reaping what you've sown.
I am reaping it. And I am trying to learn to receive it. I'm trying to learn to balance
it. Maybe you shouldn't try to learn. Maybe you ought to just accept it and enjoy it.
I know.
Just trying to. I don't think you would take this kind of stuff from anybody on your radio show,
right.
Barbara. I'm not going to let
you do
this either.
And that's that efforting part of me that has always in my life worked hard for everything. Uh-huh. And now that...
So that's the belief that needs to shift.
Absolutely. Absolutely. How much are you going to charge me for this session? No, that's absolutely right.
So the belief has been what about effort? In order for something to be worthwhile, it has to be hard.
I can accomplish anything if I work hard enough. And I can overcome any odds if I work hard enough. And that my value will be in how hard I work. And that if you want to look at me and compare me to somebody else, there's nobody who's going to do it in a more, you know, focused, passionate way than I will. Now, what about when I don't have to work for it? Where's my value then? Well, yes. It's just in my being. And so that has been a shift for me, absolutely. Learning to catch up with the level of fame I have has been kind of strange. I mean, you know, people, you know, when you shift into visible media, you know, yes. The infomercials you're doing and everything else, suddenly, I mean, I am stopped every 5 minutes on the street. And
I have that privilege too. Now, what's your reaction when that happens?
Well, it's interesting. I was just talking about this the other day. I'm doing this big speech in LA and my picture's all over town right now. And the other day I was in a shopping mall, very unusual. I call it retail therapy. one of the things I do once in a while.
Is that one of those other differences between men and women?
The zen of shopping. I shop in a zen way. I'll tell you about that sometime. I really do. I'm not kidding either. I can't go with anyone else. I just hone in. It's a very intuitive process. But I was walking around. I was out in public, so to speak, for about 4 hours, and everyone was staring at me. And it took me 3 hours, and I kept thinking, is my hair frizzy? Do I have a run in my stocking? Is there something wrong with me? My makeup? And it finally dawned on me because somebody stopped and said, oh, I just saw your picture. And then I started looking on the streets, and there's these boxes in the learning annex in there. And that's my reaction. I never get it. My boyfriend will say, these people at the next table recognized you. I will just think they're staring. And I don't know.
I got a question for you. I'm wondering if it was easier if you didn't have to push so hard and you weren't in that position. Do you feel like you'd lose your drive?
No, my drive is so...
I was going to say, because I don't see your drive.
No, it's not at all. And it's not so much even pushing. It's been more expressing. I mean, right. I've done it for myself. I have not done it for gain. I just have... outrageous amount of energy. I had a psychic channel who I go to often tell me that I decided to come in with probably about twice as much intensity as most people. And so I feel joy more intensely. I see things, colors, taste. I also feel pain more intensely and fear more intensely. And that it was a choice that I made. And boy, did it ring true for me. I mean, I live at a frequency that is so high. I mean, you know, you're one of the few people I relate to that way. And it's not always easy for other people to keep up with me. It's not always easy to be around me. I expect so much, but not of them, just of everything.
Yes.
And now what I'm finding is I am really trying to make balance. I'm turning down more things than I accept right now. I'm watching my ego say, but you can't turn that down. And realizing I have to have free time. I have to continue to live and enjoy these benefits. Otherwise, what's the point? So I'm really having to question my values. Success has made me question my values more than failure ever did.
So let's address that issue, because I think a lot of women in our culture are dealing with that issue for the first time in history. That is, they've been taught that here you should go out and become the successful businesswoman, let's say, for example. But how can you do that and really take care of your relationship? And how can you do that and really take care of your kids?
Mm-hmm.
And you're not in a position of having kids, but you are in a position of wanting to nurture your relationship. So how do you do that amidst all of this? Is it just setting down and saying, this is the limit, or this is the specific time I'm going to be with
this person I love? Oh, absolutely. I mean, I schedule him in all the time. I mean, he is my priority.
How does he feel about that?
He schedules me in. He's just as busy as I am. You know, he's building a chiropractic practice. He has patients. But I spend tons of time with him. I mean, that is the, he is the most important thing in my life. The relationship is the most important thing in my life.
And in that sentence, I hear the success of your relationship.
I mean, that's, it's the truth.
Yeah.
And it's scary to have it that, be that way. But, I mean, when was it? A few weeks ago. I don't know. I guess I heard that People Magazine was doing a story on me and CBS. And he had... separate from that, giving me a little card that day. That card made me happier than anything else that happened to me. Now, that's wonderful, and it sounds great, and it's also scary, because many times I think, would I be enjoying all of this right now if I were not in a relationship? I don't know the answer to that. I don't want to know the answer to that. I really believe on one level I'll always be taken care of. I have always found whoever I needed to be with, but I really, life is complete for me in relationship, and it doesn't have to be that way for everybody, but I learned so much from that process. I mean, that is my meditation, that is my aerobics, emotional aerobics. That is my teaching. It's my constant seminar process, and I am totally addicted to it. I am the cleanest person you've ever met. My diet, I've never done drugs, I've never drunk, but love, I'm an addict.
Well, a pretty healthy thing to be addicted to. Maybe it's being addicted to life.
I think so. They are the same thing to me.
Me too. Let me ask you a couple of final questions. What's your most treasured memory in your life so far?
I was surprised that this came up. 2 years ago, I was in the process of getting a divorce. And the marriage had ended in a messy way. I was not proud of how it ended. I'd fallen in love with somebody else. There was all kinds of complications. And I was in a tremendous amount of pain because I had wanted this marriage to work so badly, and it had not. And I felt I had failed because I had not rescued my partner and fixed him. 2 days after we decided to separate, and I was just in bed hysterical, I had a seminar to give. And there were people coming from all over the country, hundreds of them, coming to the Love Doctor to fix their relationships. And I didn't know how I could even go on. My staff, I had to tell them about it. They were shocked. How could you get a divorce? And how could this happen? And, you know, all the scandal. And I realized that there was only one way for me to do it, which was total honesty, and not to walk in and pretend everything was fine. And I was scared to death because of my picture that, and we've seen this earlier in our talk, that if I'm perfect, I'll be loved. But if I'm not, I won't be. So I walked in, eyes completely red, looking like a wreck. And the first thing I said, and they're all clapping, here we are from all over the country, you know, and I said, I'm in a lot of pain. I am going through the same thing you are. I'm going to take the seminar with you. I'm going to do all the processes. I need this. Thank God it's here. And I trust this seminar for you and for me, and hopefully it'll work for both of us. And I was scared to death because usually I am, you know, the ultimate cheerleader, visionary, and they just all kind of surrender to my belief that they can do it, and they take the leap and, you know, walk through the emotional fires. And I poured my heart out all weekend. I cried hysterically. I shared. I called on myself. I did every process.
Called on yourself.
Yes, you know. And Saturday night, and I mean, it was really bearing my soul. Saturday night, a man came up and said, are you ready to take another leap? And I said, what does he want? The details of what I did? And he said, close your eyes. And he put on our tape recorder, the Bette Midler song, Wind Beneath My Wings, and had the lights turned down. And the whole room sang the song to me. And they all came up on stage, and this is 200 people, and just held me. And I wept from such a deep place. I was having past life memories. I was experiencing unconditional love for the first time in my life, that I had let it in. They did not love me because I was perfect, because I was a teacher. They loved me because I was Barbara. And I felt so cleansed and healed in that experience. I just sat there and wept and wept and wept for 15 minutes. And they kept playing the song over and over again. And they just swayed around me. And I really felt that they had been sent from God to heal something very deep in me. My life really changed after that. I changed the way I deal with people, the way I teach, how much I let people in. It really cured me of feeling I have to be perfect to be loved. And my style has even relaxed more in the last few years than it was before that. And I will have infinite gratitude to that man and those people, because I needed to learn that more than anything else in my life. And I know I will continue to learn it, but that experience of it stands out as a very timeless moment of the truth about who I was.
How wonderful and nice for people to realize that in a moment a whole life can be changed, and that change has a processional effect now on millions of people. So that's pretty wonderful. Where do you see yourself 5 years from now?
Hawaii. I've thought a lot about that. I feel such a commitment to our planet, to millions of people I haven't even met, to really making a difference. I don't see myself pulling back from what I do. I have to decide if I want to have a family or not. I can't really see it right now. I don't want to miss out on something very special, but I don't want to be either a 50% mother or a 50% teacher. And so it's a decision I have to make. I'm sure I'll make the right one, but it's scary to have to make it. I would like to be, someone asked me once, who was interviewing me, you know, you're becoming famous. Did you ever want to be famous? And I said, no, but I want to be influential. I want to be influential enough to go in the school system and have them say, oh, you know, how would you like to change what we do? I would like to really create a loving place in which we all live. I am a total idealist and visionary, and I'm not going to let go of that. As much as I can do, I want to do. I really know I've been sent here for a reason. I'm not the most brilliant thinker in the world or the most original thinker, but I really understand communication. I think I know how to take important concepts and ideas and reach people and touch them. And I want to touch as many people as I can and open their hearts to love, hopefully so that at the end of my life, there will be millions of people who are living much more loving lives because of whatever I did. And however I'm meant to do that, I'm up for the job.
Well, you're doing an incredible job, and it's been our privilege to be with you here. I'm sitting here, and I'm gearing myself down, because otherwise I'd dominate this interview going right back at you, because I feel like I'm looking into a mirror of all the things that I respect and love most in people, and hopefully that I respect and love myself and you. And I'm very, very appreciative of this, and I hope our friendship will grow over the years.
Thank you.
I'm sure it will. And I want to make sure I recommend both books again. Again, I read them both last night. I'm totally impressed, as you can imagine. I couldn't sleep till I completed them. How to Make Love All the Time and Secrets About Men That Every Woman Should Know. And I guess the last thing I'd like to ask you is, how do you want to be remembered? I think I know the answer, but I'd like to hear it from you. When this journey is complete, at least in this plane.
As someone who reminded people of the importance of love.
You've already done that, so that's complete. And it'll be nice to see it just continue to expand throughout the years. Thanks again.
Thank you.
God bless.